From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It is time for an annual Connections tradition, Rochester and the Finger Lakes region's favorite books. And I'm here with producer Megan Mack. Hello.
Hello.
We've invited people from across our region, from a wide range of life and work backgrounds. These are short interviews that answer this question. Of everything that you read in 2015, what is your favorite and why?
Our guests include artists, educators, scientists, religious leaders, journalists, so many more.
And we're dividing the interviewing duties because we had a lot to squeeze into these 2 hours.
So let's get started. It's our chance to find out what our community has been reading, kind of an insight into how their minds work, and it's also a chance to get some ideas about what we might want to read in 2016.
We open the hour with a conversation on a book that I have not read, and I was just saying, of all the books that you're going to hear these 2 hours, this is the one that I want to read the most, and I probably should have read by now, and I will in 2016. Sean Brown is my guest. He is the program coordinator for Teen Empowerment. It's great to have you back here. How are you?
Good, Evan. Thank you. Thanks for having me, man.
Remind our listeners what Teen Empowerment is.
So Teen Empowerment, we're a youth organization, and our big focus is hiring young people to be youth organizers. Those youth organizers address the issues that young people face in the southwest neighborhood of Rochester. We're located at 392 Genesee Street on the west side of the city, and our motto is being a neighborhood program. The youth organizers address things on a street level with their peers by running events that are meaningful and impactful and powerful and filled with real community, nonviolent messages. Then they also fight this war on an institutional level by working with the mayor's office, city school district, and really trying to affect things from the top and the bottom so we can meet in the middle and have a more peaceful, vibrant, and productive and nonviolent Rochester.
Very good. Well, the book that you chose is one, again, that I can't wait to read, even though I know it may not be pleasurable, maybe painful at times. What's the book?
It's Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I always say Mr. Coates, I always kind of mess up his first name. But it's a wonderful book. Basically, it's a letter to his son. Just kind of about being a black man in America, what that means, the historical reference of that, institutional and structural racism, the violence and the black on black crime, and all the travesties that kind of happen to folks in this country with the history of slavery. But also, the thing I took away was that the positivity and the fact that he talked about us being a proud people. And a people full of potential and with so many good characteristics and so many good things that we're doing in the world, and to also focus on that too and kind of see that holistic picture of really what we are in this country and what we can be.
What would you tell our listeners, what do you think they will get out of this book, no matter their racial background, no matter their socioeconomics? Why should they read this?
I think it's just the story of an oppressed people in this Western society, this place we call America. And I think really giving people a glimpse to the unfairness, the injustice that kind of happens to people of color in this country, and really to kind of see the institutional side of it, that, you know, there's a system at play. And I think sometimes as black people, we don't see what's really going on with the system. And I think sometimes as white people, they don't really want to be forced to like look at the issue either. If you've never really been the victim of prejudice, been the victim of racism, made to feel less than, had opportunities taken away or denied to you based on the color of your skin, I think that's one of those things that is hard for people to understand, but it's a story that anyone in America, around the world, needs to hear and should understand, because there will be a time in all of our lives when we're on the outside looking in. And that's a hard feeling to deal with, especially when you know it's one of those things like I didn't have any say on my gender, my ethnic background, the color of my skin, and to be born into a world, into a system where my skin being brown is looked down upon. I'm seen as a criminal, a thug, as being bad. That's a difficult thing to live with sometimes. And I feel like Mr. Coates does a good job of like really talking about history and giving people a view into that world.
The book is Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Sean Brown, Program Coordinator for Teen Empowerment. Send our best to everyone at Teen Empowerment. Happy New Year, and looking forward to more conversations in 2016.
You're welcome, Evan. Thank you.
Our next guest is the Dean of the Eastman School of Music, and Jamil Rossi is here talking about his favorite read of 2015. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I've already learned a lot about your book without even turning a page of it, just seeing it. What's on the cover here? What's the book that you chose?
So I chose the book Traps, the Drum Wonder. It's about the life of Buddy Rich and written by the great jazz singer Mel Torme.
What brought you to this book to begin with?
So it was introduced to me by a friend who asked if I had read this book, and as all good books, you know, that's a great place to start.
Sure.
And, you know, when I was a young kid, really in high school, my heroes were people like Maynard Ferguson and Stan Kenton and Buddy Rich. They were the last titans of sort of big bands. And so in the 70s, early 80s, they were sort of the end of an era of the big bands, and a new generation of people were starting with other kinds of ensembles. Of those three bands, I loved them all, but Buddy Rich's was the band that really could swing.
And when it comes to this biography, then, did you learn a lot more about him? Did you gain more appreciation?
I did, because, again, I came to him in the last 10 to 15 years of his life. And so this book is a chronological book. He was a child prodigy. He performed in his parents' vaudeville act starting at age 4 and really was a prodigy and never left the stage. And it was amazing to me to find out sort of what his early life looked like. But then what was really interesting was to see his early involvement in bands like Artie Shaw's and especially the Tommy Dorsey Band, and that he was against his parents' wishes, wanted to go into jazz when they didn't feel that was really a route. But he knew that was something he had to do, and it was really interesting to read about that.
What are you most excited about for 2016?
I'm looking forward to moving a couple of projects forward that are physical plant projects. One is renovating Kilburn Hall. It's just a very, very special jewel box with 50-year-old seats that are incredibly uncomfortable. So we're looking forward to doing that this summer. Next summer, really doing some major work on the Eastman Community Music School. Again, it's one of, I think, Rochester's treasures. But the building that houses it hasn't really been touched in decades.
Jamil Rossi is the Dean of the Eastman School of Music. The book you chose, again, the title and the author?
Traps, the Wonder Drummer. The author is Mel Torme.
Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you in 2016.
Thanks, Evan.
Our next guest is Christine Radarsky, Rochester City historian, and she is joining us to talk about her favorite book of the year. Christine, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, my book was written by a prominent public historian here in New York State. His name is Bruce Dierstein, and the title of his book is The Spirit of New York, Defining Events in the Empire State's History. And one of the things I really like about this book is, you know, sometimes history can be very dense. This is a really engaging book, and it's also very informative. It gives you a nice overview of some of the main episodes in New York State's history. What he does is he focuses on 16 events divided into 15 chapters, and each chapter is really a story. They're all organized chronologically, and he points to several themes in New York history that he thinks that these events demonstrate. But what I like best is that it's really engaging. He tells stories. So each of these events is very interesting, very fun to read about. And also he focuses on the personalities involved. So you learn what happened, but also about the people involved.
The human element.
Exactly.
That's nice. Are there any Rochester stories in there?
There are a few mentions of Rochester. The one Rochester story, interestingly enough, is about sewage.
Oh, what an honor.
The chapter that our city appears in is about pollution and efforts to control pollution in New York State. And the event that the chapter focuses on occurs in 1899 when our then Governor Theodore Roosevelt signed one of the first anti-pollution acts in New York State. He signed an order to clean up a creek that ran through Saratoga Springs and Ballston Spa area, which at the time was a tourist area. And people were complaining about the stink and the foul-looking water. And so Teddy Roosevelt required that be cleaned up. And knowing Roosevelt's background, a lot of people really expected this to lead to some bold efforts to clean up throughout New York State. That didn't happen exactly that way. And so the episode in Rochester talks about some efforts to control pollution here. Rochester had a sewer system as early as 1900, but it essentially dumped into the Genesee River. Hmm. So we had this foul river water flowing through our city. So around 1903, they hired someone to come in and investigate and try to find ways to control that. It took several years of studying and proposals, and between about 1907 and 1910, they came up with another proposal to pump the water rather than putting it into the Genesee, to pump it out into Lake Ontario. There seemed to be a thought that that would be better. So there was a lot of political wrangling, and ultimately the initial proposal was denied by the state, but in the end, that's exactly what the city started to do. So it shows again, you know, just that it takes time for things to happen.
Well, I'm glad Rochester is featured at all. That's good. Tell us the name and title of your book again, please.
It is The Spirit of New York, Defining Events in the Empire State's History.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming in. Happy New Year.
Oh, thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Our next guest, as we talk about Rochester and the Finger Lakes region's favorite books of 2015, is the executive director of NEED, Northeast Area Development. And this is a guest with a very interesting way of reading books. George Moses is here. And George, before we even get into your book or books, I love this idea of having a root book and having offshoots. I barely have enough time, I think, to get through one at a time. And you always have about a dozen cooking.
Yep. My root book is the Maxwell Leadership Bible. And I actually had a leadership Bible years ago that I let someone borrow and they didn't return it. So I was in a store and I said, I'm going to pick my book up again. I love hanging out in bookstores. And from a root book, what it allows me to do is it always goes different ways, like a story. And from the leadership Bible, where the Bible gives me that peace that just surpasses all understanding, but it also lets me look at cycles and current things that are happening today. And it took me to, the book is called Midway, The Midpoint, My Precious Memories of Times Gone By. And it's an account by Miss Victoria Brown Smith of the African-American experience in Sanford, Florida. And as folks, some people may or may not know, a lot of African-Americans actually migrated to Rochester, New York from Sanford, Florida. And this actually gives a very good accounting of what was happening at that time in Sanford, Florida, and great examples of leadership.
So for you, you read a lot of history.
I love history. I was a page in the local history and history department at the Rochester Public Library, and I was hooked since I was a teenager.
Okay. And so, but again, this concept of a root book and then kind of the branches. Right now, the root book is the Leadership Bible.
The Maxwell Leadership Bible.
And this is giving you ideas. So you're working your way through the Leadership Bible or working your way back through it, and then you have an idea to go off and read something else.
Yep. Then I always go read something else. And it's, I always have time. I was telling Megan, I have a briefcase in my car that I carry lots of, I always have books in. And at home, I have lots of books. And at my office, I have books. I always find time, like, just to read. I love, I'm one of those people who love to read.
So what percentage of books that you pick up to start are you finishing?
That's actually a great question because my wife asked me this. And I said, but it depends on what you mean as finished. Do I read every book from beginning to end? And I tell her, no. I always let my spirit lead me as the more, and it's so interesting. I always go to the most pertinent points for me. And it just always happens that way. But I have so many books that I've read so many pieces of, and I haven't really read. There's probably about a little less than 100 I've read from front to back.
Okay. Well, I love the concept. It's a nice, interesting model for us to think about, a root book and then different ideas that come with it. For me, it's when I'm reading an article and then I'll see a name or something I don't know much about, and then I find myself, stop reading that article, go Google something else.
Yes.
But you're actually picking up books to do it. So George Moses from NEED, remind our audience once again, your root book and the other book that you chose.
My root book is the Maxwell Leadership Bible. And from that, one of the other dozen books that I'm going to from there is the Midway, the Midpoint, which gives the story of Sanford, Florida from an African-American perspective.
Happy New Year, and I look forward to more conversations
yes.
with you.
Happy holidays to everyone.
My next guest is an anchor and the managing editor for News 8 in Rochester. Adam Chodak's here.
Pleasure
How are you?
To be here. Yeah. Oh, very good, as always.
Well, Adam and I are the types of people who work a lot and then parent a lot. Our kids are around the same age, and we both wish we were reading more than we do, even though I get to read more than you do just for my job.
It's the nature of your job. That's true.
That's why you're jealous, are you not?
I am insanely jealous. And sometimes you go into a list of books that you read in one night, and I can't get over it.
Well, that is the nature of this job. So, and there's only one of it, so don't go gunning for the job. But you, but we're breaking the rules for you because you read a lot of long form journalism, New Yorker, et cetera. And when Adam and I talked about, you know, he was going to pick out a book or read, you brought up not a book, but what did you choose?
So, I read a lot, as you're saying, in the New Yorker, and one article that struck me from last year was an article on Joaquin Guzman. Most people know him as El Chapo. He is the huge cocaine drug lord in Mexico. Now, why I'm trying to fit this into 2015 is there was a follow-up article by the same author, Patrick Keith. He has done tremendous work on this. As some people know, El Chapo escaped from prison down in Mexico this year. And the follow-up article was so insanely good, not just because of the article itself, but its time. It came out just hours after the escape, and the amount that Patrick Keith knew, I think, really showed me that he owned this story.
I read the initial article on the capture, and I was struck by how intricate the system was to protect El Chapo. And I'm thinking, well, they finally got him. And then he escaped. I'm going, really? Really escaped from prison? Somebody on the inside's got to be helping. What do you find?
Yeah. So first, I think that it's a huge statement on Mexican society that I didn't know a whole lot about and why those who run the cocaine trade are able to control the government. And it's partly because the government can't provide the services that you and I are used to in the United States. And so these multi-billionaires are able to fill that gap. They're the ones paying for daycare, streets, and things like that. And in addition to that, we learned again through this second escape, because he escaped in 2001, bribery is just huge. You have people working these jails that don't make a lot of money, so they're very susceptible to that. And he basically ends up running these jails. And so Keith had this detail of the prison Altiplano, and it is a maximum security prison. Now, the U.S. said, can you maybe extradite him over here? You guys aren't great at holding these guys, especially El Chapo. And they took it as a slap in the face. This was their national pride. They want to hold this guy.
How dare you?
Exactly. So they said, no, we can get him. And here he is. As summer's approaching, he escapes through a drain, some type of hole in the shower room, and there is a motorcycle waiting for him that's strapped to a rail, and he takes a motorcycle out of the prison. And as Keith pointed out in the article, this is not a Shawshank Redemption where he's got a little rock hammer and he's dispensing of the dust and the little bits of rock in the yard every day. This was unbelievably well planned. There's no way you coordinate this without the help of the guards.
So you picked this one out because not only did you learn a lot, but I hate to put it in this terms, but it's a really pleasurable read when you get storytelling like this, isn't it?
That's the one thing that really stuck out. It's one thing to do that type of digging that he did and the research. I can't imagine the hours of research, but to be able then to tell the story, and there's not one point in both articles, and the first one was enormous, not one point did you say, that was an awkward transition. It read like a novel, which is so hard to do, especially with complicated stuff where you have to get in real details.
All right, Adam Chodak from News 8, remind our listeners, usually we've been asking people to remind of the book and the author, but in this case, the author was who?
The author is Patrick Keefe, and the title of the article is El Chapo Escapes Again. And I believe the first article, the title is The Hunt for El Chapo or something like that.
Really, both worth, at least I can say from the first article, absolutely riveting read, and no surprise to follow up as well. Interesting choice. Happy New Year. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, maybe we could get a book in for 2016.
Thanks, sir.
Our next guest is longtime film critic Jack Garner. Thanks for coming to the program, Jack.
My pleasure.
And you've brought your favorite book of the year, Lawrence in Arabia.
Well, yeah, and as to preface this a little bit, I've always thought, and I've always told people, if you wonder about the quagmire that is the Middle East, I've always thought there were a lot of clues. You could go all the way back to David Lean's great film, Lawrence of Arabia, with Peter O'Toole. There's a scene where they're all sitting around a table, and the various Arab tribes can't even figure out who's going to run the waterworks and who's going to run the electric company. And so it's sort of like an indication then of the tribal problems that still exist in a lot of ways today in the Middle East, whether you want to call it tribe or whatever, sex. A book came out recently that kind of reinforced that for me, and it was fascinating to read. It's called Lawrence in Arabia, and it's a nonfiction work. It's an historic book. I mean, it's a history book is what I'm trying to say, and it's very well-researched, And it follows four different main characters. One, of course, is Lawrence, the real story of Lawrence and his situation in Arabia and the English and what happened after the war and how they divided up that area. There's also a minor German diplomat and spy whose story is told. There's an American oil man descended from a Yale family. And, of course, that gets into the whole Standard Oil situation in the Middle East and how that became a major factor. And there's also a Romanian-born agronomist whose story is told and how he tries to find some sort of way to make the Middle East work as well. So these stories of these four characters reinforce that idea that of the real challenges and how it all started in World War I when they used the Arab culture to fight this European war. And then when it was over, they divided up the spoils in a way that left everything a shambles. So anyway, I highly recommend, especially those of you out there like me who love and admire Lawrence of Arabia, you may want to read this book. Or if you're interested in the roots of the problems in the Middle East, I highly recommend Lawrence in Arabia.
All right. Thank you so much, Jack. Thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
It's the Favorite Books of 2015 from Rochester and the Finger Lakes, and our next guest is from just down the hall. Our colleague Mona Segetola-Slami, who is an afternoon host on Classical 91.5. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Evan.
How are you?
Doing pretty well. Busy at the end of the year, of course.
Do you read a lot?
I do. Not as much as I used to. Used to read a lot as a kid, especially when I was supposed to be practicing viola. I'd actually be reading a book.
Isn't that like the saddest thing, that we have to fight for time in our own lives just to carve out time to read?
Yeah. And then the New Yorker, it piles and piles and piles.
I know. I've said it many times. I ordered the New Yorker just to remind myself of all the great writing I won't have time to read. You know, to have regret.
And then you binge on it sometimes.
Yeah, right, exactly. So your favorite book of 2015?
So I read the book Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. It's a graphic novel, came out over a decade ago, I think 2000, and I haven't seen the movie yet. It was made into a movie 2007, and I picked it up in part because I wanted to kind of connect more with my family's heritage. My dad's from Iran, but I grew up here. I was born in New Jersey, and I've never been to Iran, and this is about, well, it's the author's story of growing up as a young woman in Iran and going through the Islamic Revolution and how her life changed, and it's a lot of young girl growing up stuff, but all this stuff happening around her, too.
Tell me if you feel like you are learning. I mean, is this a way to learn about the culture? Is it entertaining? You know, is it sort of a mix for you?
It's very, very entertaining. It's a really good story. The drawings are really affecting, and I really like it. But it's also, it is a way for me to understand a place. I see people's names that are the same as my cousins' and aunts' and uncles' names, but I don't speak Farsi. I was raised Catholic, so it's also a very different world. But also to see a young woman, someone like me, who would be, you know, as a kid and teenager, into bands, into, like, boys and stuff, going through all this. The most affecting things to me, there's a scene where they're told the girls have to wear the head covering, and they're little kids. They don't know. They're throwing it across the classroom. What do we do with this? And then the other thing that really caught me, and I didn't expect from it, is to see the parents who, in the book, they don't like the Shah. They're happy there's a revolution. They're Marxists. They're progressive. And then the religious fundamentalists take over, and they say, how did this happen? That's not what we wanted to happen. How did everyone vote for something so bad for them? And then I think about our culture now a little bit.
Oh, interesting. Well, Mona Segetola-Slami, I'll see you down the hall as usual. Happy New Year. And remind our listeners once again the name of your favorite book and the author.
Sure. The name of the book is Persepolis, and the author is Marjane Satrapi.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
My next guest is one half of Poetically Connect. In fact, they're both here. Charlie Cote and Sarah Freely are here. And Charlie's on the mic right now talking about their favorite books of 2015. But before we do that, Poetically Connect is what, Charlie?
Poetically Connect is Sarah Freely and myself writing poems on demand at events around Rochester. So if you want a poem, you come and you talk to me and I'll write you a poem.
Do you read a lot of poetry?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I imagine that you do. And actually, we know several people who've had poems on demand from Poetically Connect. So really cool stuff. So you're someone who reads a lot. You read a lot of different things. What's your favorite read, book or otherwise, 2015?
Well, I have to promote my friend Sarah Freely, her book Sad Math, which just came out November 2015 by Moon City Press, which was their poetry award-winning publication that year.
Okay, and well, I know you know Sarah well, but you could have chosen anything.
I could have.
And so tell me a little bit about Sad Math then.
Well, Sad Math is a look in the mirror of family and particular experience, and it's the discovery of an authentic identity. So it's interesting to know a person as a friend, but then when you read their poetry, you really discover things not only about that person, but also about what it means to be human, and you discover things about yourself. And that's why this book was so exciting for me to read in 2015.
Charlie, when we read poetry, and frankly, I would guess a lot of American students read less poetry than we used to. But for those of us who do read poetry, you know, as a reader, are you looking for meaning? Are you simply reacting to your own emotion? How do you go into the reading of poetry?
I go into it for two things. One, I go into it to look for what it means to be alive and human. But I also go to educate my empathy and my feeling. And I also go to it for the music of poetry. So there is story, there is meaning, there's subject matter, but there's also the great music of poetry that I love.
All right. Well, Sarah Freely's book is Sad Math, and she's also here as the other half of Poetically Connect. So we're going to put her on the microphone now. Thank you, Charlie, by the way. So, Sarah, this is sort of awkward. You know, Charlie just picked your own book, and you're not picking anything he wrote.
Ah, well.
Maybe next year, right?
Well, Charlie's getting trumped by Margaret Atwood, which is, if you're going to get trumped, you might as well get trumped by a Booker Prize winner, somebody who's a poet, a fiction writer of long and short fiction, a critic, a staunch advocate for writers everywhere. So if you're going to get trumped by somebody, Margaret Atwood is not a bad one to be trumped
by. That's not bad. Not bad at all. So Sarah Freely's favorite book is by Margaret Atwood. Your favorite book you read this year is not a new book, but it's one you said you read every year. What is it?
I do read every year. It's The Blind Assassin that appeared in 2000, though she had been nominated many times for the Booker Prize. This is the one that won the Booker Prize, and it was well-deserved. This is a prize that's given to the British Commonwealth countries, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, some fine authors. And she finally won for this. To borrow a overused phrase from reviewers, it is a narrative tour de force. It is a fabulous novel. The writing is brilliant. Many times, I think, in writing novels, contemporary novels, the story will be there, but the writing won't. Or the writing will be there, and there is no story. It's not true with this one. It's a fabulous story, as well as brilliant writing. I read it every year to learn something new about narrative.
And so let me close our conversation with that question then, because I read a sort of depressing but beautiful recent essay on a website called Wait But Why that looks at the time we have in our lives, the time we have left, and that means actually counting the opportunities you have for individual interactions with family, potentially with parents or children, and individual books to read. And when you actually do it that way, there's not a whole lot left, which is this really sad thing, because if we stopped writing today, I would not have enough time to read all the amazing writing in the world. And so for someone like you who loves poetry, who loves literature, you know, we only have so much time. And this is one you come back to. Is it because the writing is so good? Do you learn something new from it? Why do you keep returning?
I do. As I said, it's a narrative tour de force. And by that, what I mean is that the narrative unfolds on about five different levels. There's the main story, a woman named Iris, who is looking back. She was 87. She's looking back on her life. There's a novel within the novel called The Blind Assassin. There's newspaper clips that fill in some of the expository background. There is her story from way back. And like any good novel, there is an element of mystery in it. It opens with this line, 10 days after the war ended, my sister Laura drove a car off a bridge. And you read the entire nearly 1,000 pages to find out why Laura drove that car off the bridge. And by the time you get there, you are so out of breath. You're in that car with her. To me, it's what Charlie was referring to. It's all about experience. Reading makes us human more than interactions on Facebook do or Twitter tweets. Reading gives us a better understanding of our relationships, familial, friends, etc. So far from being something that is a time waster, it is, in fact, you know, like something that I think energizes and adds to a quality of life.
Charlie Cote and Sarah Freely, Happy New Year to Poetically Connect. We'll see you in 2016, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Evan.
My next guest, as we talk about Rochester and the Rochester region's favorite books from 2015, is Scott Fearing, the executive director of the Gay Alliance of the Genesee Valley. Nice to have you here, Scott.
It's wonderful to be here with you today to talk about what I've been reading this year.
I didn't know you had time to read.
I have very little time, but I do try to make the occasional moments available. It's a great way to end a day.
Well, what stood out to you in 2015?
I'm actually reading right now a book that is personally and professionally very powerful. It's called For Hearing People Only, Answers to Some of the Most Commonly Asked Questions About the Deaf Community. It is a book that has a deaf author named Matthew Moore, and it brings to life the realities of deaf culture. And for myself, having a husband who's deaf, but who has not identified as part of the deaf culture.
Whoa, back it up here. See, after all the times we've talked, I didn't know your husband is deaf.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
He was raised in a very, as they would say, he was raised in a very oral family.
Okay.
So he did not learn to sign till he was in his 30s.
So very good lip reader.
A very good lip reader. And because as a kid he had some hearing, his speech is very clear. And so people assume that he's full hearing. But he, even with myself, if he can't see my face, he has no idea what I'm saying.
So what about for you? Have you learned sign over the years?
I've been learning sign. I had actually started teaching myself sign prior to meeting him. And he has been encouraging me to learn sign, but at the same time, not pushing me until about the last year, as he's been coming out, as it were, as a deaf man and into deaf culture. So he's been learning ASL, even as a student at NTID, he was learning signed English, which is very different from ASL. And so he was sort of living in a dual world and is right now really embracing his deaf culture. And this book has really been very helpful on me understanding deaf culture in very new ways. Well, and in Rochester, that's really critical. I mean, we've got one of the highest per capita deaf populations.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, I mean, this is a community that we see so many people who are deaf, who are have, you know, or I guess the other term is still hard of hearing. Is that the other term? Deaf, hard of hearing.
Deaf, hard of hearing, hearing impaired.
Hearing impaired.
The terms sort of go back and forth. For many people who were born deaf or lost their hearing at a very early age, the capital D deaf identity is very important. Many of them, like my partner Todd, does not like being called hearing impaired. He is proud to be a deaf man.
Okay.
Kind of like I'm proud to be a gay man. Very similar sort of a mentality and feeling.
Okay. And so this book would be a powerful read for all of us, even if we don't have a family member, a spouse, or a close friend who is deaf.
Absolutely. And it's really a travel guide, an introduction to deaf culture. And again, from a deaf author's point of view, but just saying, you know, here's what you hearing people need to know about us. And so it's in some ways echoes the work I've done at the Gay Alliance and throughout my professional career, trying to introduce gay culture or LGBT culture to individuals. This is sort of doing that around deaf issues, and it's very approachable. And it's a big book. It's a thick book. It's a lot of reading to go there, but it's fascinating so far.
All right. Scott Fearing is the executive director of the Gay Alliance, and the book he chose, again, the name of the book and the author, Scott?
For Hearing People Only, Matthew Moore is the author.
Happy New Year, and we'll see you in 2016.
I look forward to seeing you.
Our next guest is Teresa Bowick. She's a nurse here in Rochester and the captain of the Conky Cruisers and host of Health Beats on WDKX. Welcome, Teresa. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Megan. I'm excited to be here and share my book with you.
Tell us about your book. What is the title?
The book is Walk Like You Have Somewhere to Go by Lucille O'Neal, who, of course, is the mother of the basketball great Shaquille O'Neal.
Fantastic. And tell us a little bit about what's in the book.
Lucille's book is her 40-year journey from what she describes as mental welfare to mental wealth. And she talks about the ups and downs of teenage pregnancy, of alcoholism, of divorce, of rejection, of depression, and really finding her place in life and being able to pay it forward. It's funny, it makes you laugh, it makes you cry, but in the end, you're really inspired and feel like you want to walk like you have somewhere to go.
Mm-hmm. Where did you come across this book?
She was here in Rochester as the keynote speaker for the YWCA annual luncheon. So in addition to getting her book signed by her here in Rochester, I had an opportunity to chat with her for a few minutes. And she's just a phenomenal woman. in spite of just being Shaquille's mom, but just to hear her love and her passion for life and how she really found herself in a situation surrounded by wealth, but indeed feeling very poor inside. And when she was able to tap into the woman and find her purpose, fulfill her goals of education, going back to college. And it was funny when she talked to Shaq about going back to school, and he said he would only pay for it if she got good grades.
No pressure.
No pressure, Mom.
So you're someone, you have a great sense of humor. You love to laugh. What about the book is so funny to you?
When she talks about her height and how at times she felt like she felt awkward. And then she was really able to take control of that height and use it to her advantage. And for a while there, she became a big bully herself. And she talks about a number of fights and how she became Big Lou in the neighborhood. And then she was able to embrace that height and say, you know what? I'm beautiful as I am. So she went from this journey of her height, and she laughed about, you know, how at times, you know, she was ridiculed, and then she took control of that. And then it was almost as if she blossoms right before your eyes in the book.
What would you say to our listeners if they're sort of on the fence? Should I read it? Should I not? What stood out to you the most? What made it your favorite book?
It was when she talked about responsibility, and I just want to read this little piece of the book. And she talks about, so for readers that are looking for that inspirational read, like you're going into the new year and you're like, I need a boost, I need a kick in the butt to get started on whatever it is I want to achieve in 2016. This is what Lucille O'Neill has to say about responsibility. What do you know about taking responsibility? Know that it works sometimes like a two-sided coin. Responsibility rewards. Taking responsibility can mean three things: recognizing what you're responsible for, recognizing who you're responsible to, and acting responsible at all times.
That's a powerful message. Tell us the name and title of your book again, please.
This book is Walk Like You Have Somewhere to Go by Lucille O'Neill.
Thank you, Teresa. Thanks for coming in with us today, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you as well.
My next guest is Peter Jemison, the historic site manager at Ganondagan, and Peter's on the line with us now. Peter, your favorite book from 2015 was what?
Iroquois Creation Story. It is a very interesting book. Its author is actually John C. Mohawk. John is deceased. But it is based on an oral tradition of our people that was recited by a chief named John Arthur Gibson, who was Onondaga. He recited that to an anthropologist who was Tuscarora, whose name was J.N.B. Hewitt. And this all took place about 1896. And then eventually Hewitt translated this from the Onondaga language to the English language. He finally typed it up. And then that text sort of existed for some time, a very difficult text to read, actually, until John Mohawk created an annotated version of it. And so then he self-published a book, Iroquois Creation Story, which is the book for me in 2015 that I found the most fascinating.
What's your biggest takeaway from this book?
My biggest takeaway from this book is that people exist in the context of nature, and that nature has provided us with untold gifts which have been of a benefit to us, and all and everything that we are or will be is because of what has come from nature, and that nature has shaped society versus society shaping nature. We are not in control of the natural world. We exist within the natural world. We try to control the natural world. And over again, we are given illustrations of how little we can actually control the natural world, if you follow my drift.
Well, that doesn't make us stop trying, I guess.
That doesn't make us stop trying. And, you know, the thing is, that we shouldn't live in fear of nature, that we should embrace nature and the natural world and see ourselves as one of those who can actually, you know, offer some protection of it and offer some protection of those things that exist in the natural world. And that this is a great gift that we have been given, this planet, this ecosystem that we've inherited, this gift of the sun, which is of just the right temperature for us to exist here, of the water sources, and even those that are dealing with drought, have to continue to believe that nature will eventually find another way to bring about, water. It may take time and it may be difficult. We're challenged with all of these things.
Peter, thanks for sharing the book. And once again, the name of the book and the author?
Iroquois Creation Story. The author is John C. Mohawk. If I may say so, our gift shop at the Seneca Art and Culture Center carries this book.
Well, wonderful. Peter, thank you, and look forward to more conversations in 2016.
Thank you, Evan.
More book recommendations and conversations about the favorite books of 2015 in the Rochester Finger Lakes region. Our second hour coming up.